Paul's claim in the letter to the Galatians, which was Paul's first letter, in the second chapter of that letter, where he's discussing his aversion to everything that occurred at the Jerusalem summit, where he says of these individuals, and he has really two groups of individuals that he's addressing. One is folks who he claims were false brothers who sneaked into the room to secretly steal away their freedom, which is preposterous. And the second is that he refers specifically to the disciples, saying that these were people that supposedly had credibility and were supposedly important because of the things that had occurred in their past. So he is discounting both. And he's saying that he didn't submit to them, neither for a moment nor an hour, so that the truth of God might be associated among you. So it's just weird for him to say that. And should you be curious, the only people with the authority to enslave Paul and thus silence him would have been representatives of the Roman government. Not even the Sanhedrin could have done so because Paul was a Roman citizen. So think about this. He's saying, oh, I was brave. I kept those people from oppressing me, from causing me to be subservient to them, which means to be enslaved by them, so that you could know the truth. Well, there was no one in Israel that could have done that. There was no Christians had absolutely no power. In fact, there wasn't even a Christian church at that point. It was strictly followers of the way. And they had absolutely no influence. They couldn't have imposed anything on anybody. They were just trying to survive. So it couldn't have been followers of the way. Couldn't have been the disciples. There isn't one place ever where the disciples are trying to impose their will, lording over people, causing them to be subservient. So it's not the disciples. Couldn't be members, just followers of the way. Couldn't be, Christians will say it was the Judaizers. Well, that would be the Sanhedrin. It would be the Pharisees. But the reality is, because Paul was a Roman citizen, the Sanhedrin and the Pharisees had absolutely no influence over Paul. They could not make him subservient because they would be subservient to him because they were not Roman citizens. He was. Now, of course, the other issue is Yosha was overwhelmingly opposed, vehemently opposed to the Sanhedrin and to the Pharisees. So they would never have been part of the Jerusalem Council that was called by Shimon Kefesh, known to us today as Peter. So there is not a scenario that you can conceive where Paul's rhetoric is the least bit rational. So the Sanhedrin couldn't have imposed their will on him because Paul was a Roman citizen. Moreover, as a rabbinical student in Jerusalem, Paul would have known the members of the Sanhedrin and the members of the Pharisaic order, would have known them personally. They couldn't have snuck in. They couldn't have been false. They couldn't have done any of these things. He would have known them. And if it was them, he would have said, hey, it was the Pharisees. The Pharisees got into the meeting, and the Pharisees wanted to impose something. He could have said the Sanhedrin, they came into the meeting. They wanted to impose something, but no. No. Paul is creating an illusion here. A straw man, a false enemy. So, Shaul would have known them, as I said, personally, and as we will discover, Rome's allegedly imprisoning Paul didn't silence him. You know, many of Paul's letters were written, allegedly, from prison, although there is actually no indication at all that Paul was actually imprisoned. There is a possibility that he was under house arrest for something, but Rome would have had no issue with Paul I mean, there's nothing that Paul said or did that would have created any issue for Rome. As a matter of fact, in Paul's treatise, which is the letter to the Romans, Paul is imposing on those who believe him the very line that Rome wanted to impose, that the governments were chosen by the gods, and that everyone should submit to the government, and that you have no free will when it comes to the government submitting to the edicts of the government without question, is what Paul wrote in the 13th chapter of Romans. They'd have loved it. And, of course, the God that Paul was communicating was modeled after Bacchus and Dionysus. They would have liked that. And he was espousing Gnosticism, which was the very philosophical approach that the Greeks and then the Romans who adopted their thinking ascribed to. And if you look at Hadrian, who would come a little bit later, Hadrian was an initiate in the Dionysian religious council, and he was a huge proponent of Gnosticism. Plato, Aristotle, the notion that the real world was therefore the flesh was a impoverished and flawed version of a perfect and spiritual world out there. Now, the Gnostics were wrong. Plato, Socrates, Aristotle were wrong, but it resonated with Romans and Greeks. There was nothing that Paul was writing or saying that would have put him at odds with Rome. So, who is his enemy? Well, God, the disciples themselves. Glenn, I know you're still there. I don't know if you're just listening or want to chime in, but I am at a crossroads here. I cannot determine anyone that Paul was talking about here that would have been anyone other than the disciples themselves. There is, and they were not in a position where they could have made Paul subservient to them, and there's no other cast of characters that would have had any influence over Paul or any desire to do anything with Paul.
That's possible. You just unfortunately reminded me of a line from the movie The Princess Bride, where this guy goes, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, moron! Anyway. And there's a certain percentage of your audience that will get that. Knowing the movie. As to Paul, I mean, well, yeah, they, I like the way he says, he refers to them as supposedly having notoriety because of their past activities or something. It's like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't have a nice, fresh, a vision on the road there where because due to the accounts, we're never quite sure who heard or saw what, because it's ambiguous and contradictory as to what exactly happened.
Right, and it's kind of interesting, of course, is that Yosha healed the blind and gave them sight. With Paul, he had sight, and his experience on the road to Damascus blinded him. That doesn't sounds like the inverse of Yosha. Yosha was constantly empowering and healing the lame. And yet Paul, who was ambulatory and was vicious by his own accord, was made lame by the experience and required days of rehab. Doesn't sound like the same fella to me, does it, you?
No.
No.
I mean, we see some of the prophets, talk about how it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, or how, mm-hmm. Overwhelming or empower, powerful their experiences of Yahweh through the, Ruach Kodesh, presumably, mm-hmm. were, but not debilitating,
Correct.
They weren't injured or damaged.
No, uplifting, empowering, enriching, but never debilitating. And, of course, on the road to Damascus, Paul puts Dionysus's most famous line in his God's mouth. Do you find any place where Yosha quoted anyone other than Yahweh? Is there a famous line from a play, you know, it's difficult to kick against the goat mm-hmm. being the sharp-pointed stick to herd dove animals, and what the play is saying to Greeks was that it is very difficult for you to rebel against religious authority. That religious right. authority is so pervasive that and you're goaded as a dumb animal as part of a religious society, and it's that if you try to rebel against that, it's extraordinarily difficult, and that has been the case throughout time.
Well, that seems especially damning, because the idea of Yahweh borrowing from that is just ridiculous.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. But yet Paul ascribes those words to his God, and there is a 0% chance that Yahusha would have ever quoted a play like that, particularly since what's the first requirement for participating in the covenant?
Circumcision?
No, that's the fifth. The first is to walk away from the goat, reject the goat. Don't allow yourself to be manipulated by your country, by religion, by politics. You need to avoid being dependent and manipulated by those things. Walk away from them. And so the first requirement of the covenant is in direct opposition to the statement that Yahusha would be was ascribed to Yahusha by Paul of it's difficult to protest against the goat, because here he's not saying that you should reject politics and religion, because Paul wrote exactly the opposite. You should embrace politics and religion. But he's just saying, you know, it's hard to reject religious influence, you shouldn't do it.
Well, I think it's interesting that the come away thing. It just reminds me of the cliche that the first step to getting out of a pit is to stop digging.
Come away.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to stop.
Oh, we have. Are you still there, Glenn? I know you broke up. I'm sorry, Glenn. So as we continue this thought, we realize that the Romans had, if they had wanted to silence Paul, they could have. But there certainly was no Roman influence, and Paul was a Roman citizen. If someone was in that meeting that was an agent of the Roman government, then the last person they're going to be concerned about is Paul. It's the non-Roman citizens that they would have sought to control. Glenn, I know you wanted to make a point, but I'd like to ask you a question. If Yahweh was unable to protect Moshe, who was 80 years old at the time that he asked him to work with him to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, if he was unable to protect him, and let's say that Pharaoh killed Moshe, do you think God would have just said, oh, well, so much for that plan, you can just stay here, I'm going to go back to heaven, see you later? Or do you think God would have turned to someone else and say, okay, let's work together? When Yahweh reached out to Jeremiah to share his insights to Gentiles about religion and his opposition to religion, had Jeremiah just said, no, I am too young, I'm not going to do it, do you think Yahweh would have found someone else?
I think he seems to have the time on his hands, you know, to persevere and get what he wants done.
Yeah. So do you think that let's just say pretend for a moment that God inspired Paul to contradict him and to annul everything that he had said. Let's just say that God said, you know, I really can't. My plan was really pretty crappy. And this guy's got a much better plan than what I had. And so I'm going to toss out everything I'd done in the past, and I'm going to authorize this guy to come up with a whole new plan because I was so incompetent. Let's just say that but he's still the creator God of the universe. He created the universe. Do you think that if these false brothers had somehow made Paul's subservient to them, had enslaved Paul, kidnapped him or something. Do you suppose that God would have been out of options, or would he have found someone else?
No, he's never out of options. He can always, you know, find someone, you know, even when people think there's nobody else, who was it who said that, oh God, I'm all alone, and God said, no, I have even in this city X many people. I'm forgetting what that story is.
For example, there aren't a lot of people that are willing to do what I do here in terms of sharing what Yahweh actually said in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and to share it both in writing and on the radio. But, you know, there are a number, and if I were to say, for whatever reason, I don't want to do it anymore, for me to think that, well, that Yahweh's message isn't going to be communicated, that would be utter nonsense.
Right.
You know, I'm honored to be able to serve, but, I know my place. My place has the collective weight of Nabalant.
Right, no one's irreplaceable, you know.
Of course.
And
that's what Paul is suggesting here, that had he acquiesced to these people, that no one would have ever known the truth about God. I suppose that had Paul been somehow kidnapped, that no one could have read the Torah?
Well, yeah, no. Like, and if you accept the story, the traditional story that Yahshua was sawn in half by Manasseh, that didn't stop much of anything now, did it? And as a matter of fact, they also often have the phenomenon of the creation of martyrs, which multiplies followers and adherents and proponents, just like you talk about with Islam.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was so favorable for the budding Christian church around the time of Diocletian and then running up through Constantine to be martyrs, that they imposed the martyrdom on themselves. That there are some just marvelous quotes from Roman leaders and Roman historians where the leaders of Rome would say, if you're so intent on martyring yourself, on killing yourself, there's a cliff over there. Why don't you just run off of it? Or they would say, here's some rope. Go hang yourself. I mean, this whole idea of Roman persecution of Christians didn't exist. But Christians were so desirous of proving their faith by being martyrs, and it was so effective for the church as a whole, they promoted the idea of martyrdom. You know, if you look at Egypt today and the Copt Christians, the leaders of the Copt Christian church will tell you that the only reason they exist is because of martyrdom. And that the fact that they are being martyred by the Muslim population is what makes them strong.
First on the left.
First on the left. Yeah, the line for the crucifixion, that is first on the left. However, you're going to have to do it yourself. We're not going to be bothered. We will supply the wood and the nails should you wish to use them. Christian theologians, knowing what the founder of their religion will say next, would like you to believe that the purpose of this troubling exchange was to free believers from the Torah. That is because they, like Paul, despise God's guidance. They neither understand it nor respect it. So if you were to read any of the thousands of Christian explanations of this paragraph that has absolutely no validity in reality, all of them will say that those that snuck into the meeting were Judaizers, of which there was no such thing ever in history, still isn't, and that they were trying to force people to obey the Torah, which was a set of antiquated laws. But Torah doesn't mean law, and there's no Hebrew word for obey. And there's never has been a person called a Judaizer. Glenn, you're talk to people all the time. Have you ever met a Jewish evangelist?
Yeah, no, it's more like the other way. I remember having asking a Jewish acquaintance one time, as to why they don't evangelize or proselytize. And mm-hmm. his answer was exceedingly simple. Said, we don't have to. You know, it's not a priority, you know.
Well, it's that they view themselves as a race chosen by God, and it's true, they are. And they have created a religion based on the race. Now, unfortunately, when they claim to be a Torah observant, they're not. They're Talmud observant. And the Talmud is their presentation of what they think is an oral law passed on by men at the time as opposed to God. But Jews never Judaize, ever. That's just not something they do. They don't care if you agree with them or not. And they don't care if somebody wants to convert to Judaism, that's just fine. But it wasn't because Judaism was Judaized. It's never happened. Didn't happen then, doesn't happen now. So the very Christian explanation presupposes a condition that never existed.
Right. And yet, at the end of Matanyahu, you have the Great Commission, it's called, right, where mm-hmm. it just says, go in all the world, make disciples of all nations, you know, so there
is, what is the Greek word disciple? It's a
follower.
No, but it's all a disciple, it's not a follower. The Greek word that is transliterated, the Greek word is disciple, that is transliterated disciple, it means learner.
Mm-hmm.
Learner. It's a student.
Well,
it's a learner.
Well, yeah,
go and make learners of all men. What better condition, if the Torah is teaching, which it is, what better way to say it than go and make learners of all men? I've got teaching. Let's have men become learners, because if they learn what I'm teaching, then they're in a position to express their free will and respond appropriately.
Right. Well, in the Middle East at the time, the itinerant teacher, the roving teacher who had his followers, where students were indeed followers, they always followed him from place to place, just as, you know, the disciples followed Christ here and there, you know, and he would teach.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So there's no contradiction between following and learning in that sense.
Yeah, that is true. The term disciple is Greek for learn, to be a student and to learn, and that is what Yosha did with those that were surrounding him. He gave them the title learner, and then he said, you become learners. He has taught from the Torah. You become learners of the Torah, and now cause others to be learners of the Torah.
Yeah, I wanted to, mm-hmm. before I forget, I wanted to mention one point. This is like a modern parallel to Paul's identification with his status as a Roman citizen.
Right.
And, you know, what you talk about with politics and religion. I recently heard a really, really big and popular talk show host who's a Christian, ostensibly,
mm-hmm.
Addressing this issue of patriot activism. You know, being activistically patriotic and resisting the New World Order. And just as you say, talk about Paul saying, but I say,
mm-hmm.
he literally stated, like, basically what, you know, seemed the case to him very subjectively. His spirit, his intuition was that people who, like, sat on their, you know, haunches or their laurels and didn't get off their dust and, openly, actively oppose the imposition of the New World Order were basically going to go to hell for their, you know, lack of participation. I mean, literally a subjective, it seems to me, this is what I believe, personal revelation type. If you don't get on the ball, and even as a Christian, fight this activistically, you're going to hell. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that's pretty stunning. Particularly since Yahweh's predictions of the future are 100% accurate. Now, he is not predestining the future. He's simply reporting in our past what he has witnessed that we have done in our future. So, since Yahweh has described a one-world order, economic one-world order, religious one-world order, military one-world order, which, since he has depicted the events that lead to that condition, why would you go about trying to oppose the inevitable? I mean, I can speak against it, condemn it from a point of view that this is a bad thing, but to try to, you know, it's one thing if we ran this program, Glenn, and said, we're telling you all of this because you can make a difference. You can improve your government. You can improve your military. You can improve your, and save, you know, the country. If we were presenting these issues and we were inciting people to be activists to resolve these problems, then even without pronouncing that you're going to hell if you don't agree with us, which we would never say, but then I think we're misleading people. We're really clear, and you've probably been the most outspoken participant in the program to make this distinction. That while it has merit to expose and condemn these processes of men for militarization, for the fiat manipulation of central banks, of debt and entitlements and the like, that it's appropriate for us to expose and condemn them so people don't allow themselves to become dependent upon them and they withdraw from them. But we have never once, ever, said that you should dedicate yourself to improving or resolving these problems.
I mean, right, and it's just especially, I mean, he literally made political activism a criterion for salvation. And didn't, I don't think he even realized quite what he was doing. But when you look at the dissidence that Yalcha had towards the Roman Empire, I mean, the Way was founded as a persecuted movement within a subjugated culture, within an empire. And Yalcha never called, you know, anyone to actively oppose the tyranny of the Roman Empire. That wasn't his agenda.
But you look at what Yahweh said about the Roman Empire and Daniel, where he calls them the most vicious beast. So Yahweh's example is expose and condemn, but don't waste your time trying to reform them or to oppose them other than through rhetoric, because it is a complete waste of your time. What Yosha said ultimately, when you looked at the coin, he says, whose image is on it? Well, it's Caesar. Well, then give to Caesar what's Caesar's, and render under God what is God's. What he's telling you is that we ought to withdraw from that stuff, as opposed to engage.
Walk
away with the first condition of the covenant. Walk away from it, as opposed to engage in it. So the first, since participation in the covenant is required for salvation, a byproduct of the covenant relationship is salvation. Therefore, since the first condition to participate in the covenant is to walk away from, to disassociate from government, what this Christian host was proclaiming, tying political activism to salvation, is literally the antithesis of what not only Yahweh wrote, but what Yosha said and did.
Right. And he was literally pulling a Paul, you know, but I say, I mean, it was totally subjective from his gut, you know.
Right.
I'm like, oh, my goodness, false prophet status right there. Bing.
Oh, anyway. Yeah, exactly. It's akin to what Paul wrote in the 13th chapter of Romans, but from a different perspective. What the founder of this man's religion wrote is that we just ought to submit to the government. That government that he was talking about that is doing bad things, Paul said, no, just submit to them. They're appointed by my God. You ought to submit to them. And so this guy, as a Christian, is saying, no, you ought to oppose them. And you're saying, huh?
Right. Well, you know, he's saying submit to the old idea of constitutional America. In other words, you should be standing up for his version of what America. So it's political, you know, and he's saying obey the old America, not the new globalism.
Yeah.
You know, but
either way, you're obeying and aligning yourself with a government system. You know, I personally think there's aspects of the U.S. Constitution that are really quite brilliant. But the fact is that the U.S. Constitution plays no role in America and hasn't for a very long time. 90% of what the federal government does is way outside the guidelines of the U.S. Constitution, and the U.S. Constitution is routinely waived to impose new laws and new programs on America. You know, if you're talking about this kind of thing, you'd say, okay, then why are there any gun laws? There can't be any. According to the U.S. Constitution, there can't be any gun laws. If I wanted to own an intercontinental ballistic missile, the U.S. Constitution gives me the right to bury that baby right in my backyard. You know, if I wanted to own an A1 Abrams tank and to drive it down the street, the U.S. Constitution gives me the right to do that. If I want to bear a Beretta 9mm on my hip, the U.S. Constitution gives me the right to do that, even in New York City, even in Washington, D.C. So we're obviously not paying attention to the U.S. Constitution, which, by the way, says that the specific mandates of the federal government are delineated in the document, and anything outside of them falls to the rights of the states and the people, and yet everything the federal government is doing is not listed in the Constitution. So Christian clerics insist, and go check this out for yourself. Google the Paul's letter to the Galatians, the second chapter, and Google false brothers and see what the Christian theologians have to say about this meeting. And what you'll find is that about 90% of them will claim that the false brothers were Judaizers. But as we've discussed, that's ridiculous. Judaism is predicated on rabbinic law, upon the Talmud, and not upon Yahweh's Torah. I remember that I did a television program with a rabbinic Jew that had the flag of the Star of David. By the way, David didn't have a star, but he nonetheless had the Star of David in the background, and we were talking about my love of the Torah, and he says, you know, we religious Jews, we basically say that that the Torah cannot be interpreted by regular individuals, that the purpose of the Talmud is to explain the Torah, and therefore we are Talmud observant. And that's been the case for a very long time. Yosha made the case. Yosha said, your Talmud, it says this, that, and the other thing, and look how contradictory that is to my Torah. So in Matthew 23, he's actually exposing the difference between the Talmud and the Torah. And there isn't a single quote from Yahusha about the Talmud, nor from any one of his disciples. So this idea that they were Judaizers promoting their Talmud is ridiculous. And the idea that rabbinic law and the Talmud are coterminous with the Torah is ridiculous. And it's also ridiculous to infer that the Torah is a set of laws, because it's not. It's teaching. Further, as we've discussed, Jews do not, have not, and will not evangelize. So, once you realize that there is no credible explanation for what Paul is saying here, other than he was at war with, wholly and completely opposed to, discounting, dismissive of the disciples, and the disciples' affinity for the Torah, which is the very document that Yosha represented, that's the only conclusion here which makes any sense, and that conclusion invalidates everything Paul had to say. Am I missing something, Glenn? Is there another possibility here other than Paul's animosity was directed towards Yosha's disciples and against the Torah that Yosha represented.
Well, the apparently it looks like the intent was to create enough ambiguity to allow for it to be plausibly deniable, but it does seem, yes. I can't think of anybody else whom he would be referring to.
Oh, correct. And Paul's very weaselly in that regard. He opens the door to plausible deniability by being weaselly. He refers to the disciples as those who were deemed important because of something that had occurred in their past, as opposed to just saying that my disagreement, the people that I completely rejected, were the disciples. And then he creates these false brothers and creates the impression that they were Judaizers, when in fact there could not have been a Judaizer in the room. And there were no such things. Even if they had existed, they wouldn't have been in that group. And nothing Paul says about them makes any sense. So I guess if you're going to promote a religion based on a pile of lies, what's a whole other set of lies to justify the lies?
Well, he was also apparently antagonistic to Shimon Petesh otherwise, because there's the incident where he says he opposed Shimon Petesh to his face, for he was to be blamed, because before others, Jewish believers came down from Jerusalem, Shimon Petesh was hanging with the Gentiles, but then when his buddy showed up, he shied away.
And actually, it doesn't say blamed; it says condemned. Yeah, and there is no admonition anywhere in the Torah for us to avoid Gentiles. We're to avoid their religion and politics, but not avoid them. Yosha came for them as well.